TED Audio Collective.
Hi, I'm Debbie Millman. Canva is great for designing visual content for work, no matter what industry or department you work in. Nail your next presentation with Canva Presentations. Start with a professionally designed template and use it as a springboard for your design. It's a serious time saver. Time to present but can't be there in person? Enter Canva Talking Presentations. Record yourself presenting and add your talking head to your slides so your audience can watch your perfected presentation anywhere, anytime. Start designing today at canva.com. Designed for work.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
This is Design Matters with Debbie Millman from DesignObserver.com. On this program, Debbie Millman talks with Roberto de Victor-Cumtish about the difference between art and design, his love for serif fonts, and the importance of wit in design.
Life is hard. Like, let's give a break to the general public. Like, make life a little easier, a little, you know, gentler and happier by just this little witty thing that you can create.
Here's Debbie Millman.
The lettering of Roberto de Victor-Cumtish stands out like a good dancer on a crowded dance floor. It swoops and swishes and always impresses. No matter how tiny, each O and S and F is alive in its own gesture. De Victor began his career designing witty and ingenious book covers for publishing houses. In 2000, he published his own book, an animal ABCdery called Bembo's Zoo, from antelope to zebra, and yes, there was a unicorn. De Victor shaped each animal out of the graceful Roman letters in its own name, a typographical tour de force. He's come out with two more books since then, each devoted in its own way to type. These days, De Victor is the principal at De Victor Design. They do publication and restaurant design and branding with a focus, of course, on typography. Roberto de Victor-Cumtish, welcome to Design Matters.
Thank you, Debbie.
So the first question I want to ask you about is your name. Roberto de Victor-Cumtish, how did you get that name?
Well, the first part is Brazilian. I was born in Rio. The last name is actually a Flemish name. Vic in Old Flemish means village, and Cumtish is a place that still exists. It's only one street in the middle of Belgium. And so my great-grandfather moved from Belgium to Boston, then from Boston to Brazil, and then my grandfather was born in Boston and then moved to Brazil, and then my father was born in Brazil, and I was born in Brazil.
It's daunting, but it's quite beautiful. It's actually a really poetic name. Do you find that most people don't know how to pronounce it?
I think that probably at the end of my life, I would spend 3 years of, you know, spelling on the phone.
Oh, yeah. So, all that time.
Yeah. But besides that, you know, I mean, it's great. It's much easier to search, you know, when you have a name like that.
That's true. If you put Roberto and a D-E in Google, it comes out right
exactly,
away.
Exactly, yeah.
So you were born in Brazil, in Rio.
Yeah.
And you moved to New York City in 1982.
Yeah.
When you received a painting scholarship to go to Pratt. What made you decide that you wanted to move to New York City?
At that time, when I was growing up in Brazil, was a dictatorship, and there was like in the lower middle class. The economy was not doing very well. There was hyperinflation. I don't know if you ever experienced hyperinflation. It's like, for instance, you go to the supermarket, and there was no prices on the packages. So you have to bring the package to the cash register, and when you present the product, that would give you a price. if you presented 10 minutes later, the price would change. So it was like a bizarre situation. So we decided, like, no, Rio is a lovely place to visit. I don't know, have you ever been to Rio?
I have not, I'm sad to say.
It's beautiful, but it's very difficult to work. So I decided, like, no, I had not that many contacts. I was like, no, was, well, let's see how it is to live abroad. How is, like, to be a foreigner? I had a BA in graphic design, but the graphic design school that I went to in Brazil was very Bauhaus, was very, like, you know, the idea of modern. So the designer would have a voice. It was mostly, like, you know, that you have, like, only five or four typefaces for you to use.
Ah, so very Vignelli.
Exactly, yes. So it was very boring. So I decided, like, you know, instead of continue, you know, doing graphic design, I decided, like, let's do a master in painting. And I got a scholarship to do this. I came here. I love New York. And then I discovered graphic design that I love. I discovered Luis Fili. I discovered, like, you know, so it's, you'd start, like, you know, salivating when you see the things. So I want, like, you know, to do like that. So then I went back to graphic design.
What was the art and design scene in Brazil like in the early 1980s? Was there a scene at all?
Not that much. Actually, from all the people that I graduated, I think there are very few people who are still into design business. Nowadays, you have design because economy. I mean, design needs an economy. So, like, you know, since there was no economy at that time, it was very difficult for you to survive as a designer. Nowadays, there is. And actually, there's a very interesting typographer's designing type in Brazil as well. So there is some interesting things. On the other hand, Brazil is kind of a young country, and a lot of the design sensibility of Brazil is very much the modern. It's like, you know, Niemeyer when he created Brasilia. So it was, I mean, when you go to Brazil, one of the funny things that I find is that they don't have serif typefaces. Everything is sans serif because there is this idea of the modern. You find serif on, like, you know, small type, on books, but, like, you know, any display type is all sans serif. It's so bizarre. There's no idea of tradition, of lettering. You know, I mean, the lettering that there is like, you know, the raw signs that is done for market. So it's kind of interesting. It's an interesting place to visit and see it.
So you ended up getting a master's in painting.
Because I love art. The thing is, if you grew up in Brazil, there's no, I mean, in Rio, you have one museum of modern art. You have no Rembrandt. You have no El Grecos. You have no Rubens. So, like, everything, all your art history is based on books. It's just like, you never see any painting. So, like, of course, like, I wanted to see it. I wanted. And then when I came here, I saw it and I appreciated. But the thing with art is that I like design because design is you have a problem and you have a solution. And you have zillions of solutions. And you have a problem that existed outside yourself. Art is different. Art, you have to pose the problem. If you find a solution or not, it depends on you, depends on, like, you have to be cursed to be an artist. You know? And I think design...
You don't think you have to be cursed to be a designer?
A little bit, but not so much. I mean, the gods are a little more, relaxed and less vengeful than, like, you know, with artists.
I'm not surprised that just moments into our interview, we're already talking about your thoughts and philosophy on the role of art and the role of design. You've talked about it extensively, and it was hard to pick the bits that I wanted to quote back to you and then talk about, aside from the fact that on your website, you prominently state graphic design will save you. And I want to talk about how you believe that's possible. But I also wanted to talk to you about this sort of dichotomy between art and design. And so I'm going to read you this paragraph. You say, "Design is not art, since art exists as an answer to a question posed by an individual artist, while design exists as an answer to a question posed by the marketplace. Design must have an audience to come into being, while art seeks an audience, sometimes luckily finding it, sometimes not. Art pushes the limit of experience and language for its own sake, while design might do this, but only to humanize and integrate people's lives in the context of an economy. Design needs an economic system, while art does not. Art may become a product, but it's not the reason why it was created, but how our society transforms it into a commodity."
Sounds so much better when you say...
Well, I'm just reading your words. It's really quite extraordinary to think about a product or art becoming a product and then becoming a commodity. And I'm wondering if you have an example. I was thinking maybe Warhol. I was thinking, who do you mean by that? Or what do you mean by that?
I think the whole, I mean, our idea of art, of the artist, is like, you know, the French bohemian, like, you know, living on the little attic in, you know, in Paris, and like, you know, painting his, you know, his room.
See, I think of Damien Hirst. I don't really think about that parade artist anymore.
Well, but I think
I think of a cash register.
Well, I think, but this was like, you know, the ideal, the image that I have of what an artist should be. I mean, you shouldn't, like, you know,
I understand,
you
yes.
shouldn't compromise your art. And then, you know, when you go and try, like, you know, to do this, I mean, you have to have a 9-to-5 job, and then, like, you know, you go home at night, and, like, you know, you work from 6 to 2 o'clock in the morning, and then, and you have to have real, not only a passion, but you have a need to do that. Like, there is something that is pressing on you, because it is a very difficult life. Of course, as a designer, we're doing exactly the same thing. We work 9-to-5 and then realize that, like, we hate, not everyone, but sometimes you hate the things that you do from 9-to-5. So you have to go home and, like, do the things that you want to
do
for yourself.
The self-generated projects,
yes.
Yeah.
But it is something that, like, you see as you're creating a project that there is a marketplace, like, to absorb this project. What with our artist, it is, yeah, I mean, you know, you are making a product, but that product might, you know, you have, might a gallery like to show it? You don't know. I mean, like, you know, the genesis for an idea of art, it is something that is specifically in you. Like, you know, is a interest, is an obsession that you have. Of course, you know, designers are obsessed as well. I don't know. I mean, there are similarities, but there are, you know, a lot of things that are very different.
This reminds me of a passage in James Joyce's Ulysses where there's a big sort of existential debate that Joyce has, the character sort of thinking about this and that and this and that and sort of spinning around and around and around and big, big, big ideas. And then he starts a new paragraph. Anyway. So anyway,
yes.
How can graphic design save us?
Well, it saves me. And we can save everyone, but it saves me. I love craft design. I think that I'm very lucky. Probably you feel the same way, you know, that you find something that you like to do. And one of the things about, like, you know, work that is great is the idea of losing yourself into the work. So in a sense, it's like, you know, something you have joy, like, you know, to play with type, to play with images, like, you know, to find similarities, to find patterns, to create, you know, ideas, to transform. So you lose yourself into the work. And that's when one of the things that I say to my daughter is trying to find something that you're so passionate that you lose yourself in it. And I think that's what graphic design does for me.
So there's a little bit of lost time that I've discovered in my research, from the time that you graduated with your master's till the time you became the senior art director and vice president at HarperCollins. So what did you do in between? Because I really couldn't find what it was you were doing.
Well, that's the thing. You know, when I graduated from fine arts, so I had, like, when I came to New York, I had no portfolio. And then you are competing with people who come, like, you know, with wonderful American universities, with perfect portfolio.
I hated those people.
I mean, also, you know, it was some time ago. So in a sense, like, when I came, my portfolio was still in, like, Letraset, was, like, rubbed down.
I mean, too.
It's like, remember how it was?
Fantastic.
And then when you put the plastic sheet, like, you know, and you peeled, half of the things would come out.
I mean, like, it was a monotype.
it was a disaster. So I wanted to go in graphic design. And it was very difficult to try. So I did everything. I did, like, you know, I work designing banks in the Bahamas, you know, those, like, you know, annual report for, like, you know, these strange banks in the Bahamas. I was art director for a magazine called Your Prom. I mean, it was lovely. At one point, we were doing a photo shoot of all these girls in prom dresses. And, you know, the photographer told me, because I was putting one model near, like, the light, and says, don't close, not so close to the light. The dress is plastic. It's going to go in flames. So, I mean, I did everything that you could in order, like, to build a portfolio. So that was a kind of struggle. But it was a way of finding, you know, and that's the thing with graphic design. I mean, you grow in terms of, you know, the quality of your work, but you also try, like, to find you know, the enlightened client, the enlightened tyrant. So in a sense, that's the pursuit of graphic design, is to find like, you know, someone who believes in you, who believes in your sensibility, but also has the money to back you up.
And the courage. Yeah. But I still don't understand how you went from freelancing and working on prom catalogs and dubious bank annuals to vice president at HarperCollins and Random House.
I did a lot of working in branding. At that time, it was not even branding. It was corporate identity. And then suddenly, I was doing a lot of freelance magazines. And then I got hired by Condé Nast. First, I was designer at Vogue when Anna Wintour was coming in. And then after Vogue, I went to House and Garden, and from House and Garden, I went to Condé Nast Traveler. And then I was senior designer at Condé Nast, and I realized the only great position at Condé Nast if you are the art director. Because a designer, you already have all the typeface chosen for you, you have all the images chosen for you, it was just layouting the pages. And it was kind of interesting, but like at the end, was not, you know, I mean, also the thing is that the magazines have such a short life that when you see it, it looks, it's already garbage before it's out. I mean, it's so sad. I mean, you already, so I was by myself, you know, not very happy in New York. And I thought, like, you know, perhaps I should go to Europe, like, should see what it is to go to live, you know, in France. So I was brushing up my French and at Alliance Française, and there was this woman who was heavily pregnant, was one of the, another student in the class, and we start talking, and she was looking for, you know, to have a designer to replace her as an art director for Pantheon. It was Marjorie Anderson, who came after Louise Philly. And then so I stayed at Pantheon for 4 months, and I discovered that I love books. I mean, like the first book that they gave me to do was Il Gatto Pardo, The Leopard by Lampedusa. And I'm, oh my God, this is what I want to do. I mean, I love books. And so it was wonderful, like, you know, to design books. And also, like, you know, books are little posters, and each one is different. And each one you have to market different, and each one is a different voice. So it was, I really loved, you know. So from Pantheon, then I start freelancing mostly in book publishing, and then like, you know, I start like, you know, working. First, I was art director of Basic Books, then I was art director of Broadway Books, and then from Broadway Books, I went like into HarperCollins, and then I realized that it's great. I mean, I love the corporate ladder, but at one point, you become more manager than you are hired because of your design skills, and then like, you know, the last thing that you do is design. You don't know, you manage people. So I decided that better like not to do open my own stuff. And
now, I read that while you were at HarperCollins that you oversaw the design of over 1,500 book covers a year.
Yeah.
And also actually designed over 200. How is that possible? It's like one a day, one a business day.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there was a lot of staff there, but also it is fast. It's not like there is the great books that like they spend, you know, a lot of time trying like to come up. But there are other things that have to be out of the door. And I think it's good. I mean, time is also essential. You have to manage your time. Your ideas have to be when you are taking a shower, not when you're in front of the computer. I mean, that's when you have your ideas. So it's okay. I mean, I actually love, you know, the fast pace. I think like sometimes when you have too much time, it becomes like there's too much to consider. I mean, there's always, again, design, you don't only have one solution. You can have zillions of solutions. So in a sense, you know, time is one of the components that make the, you know, the solution specific for that point in time.
On your website, you have a lot of examples of books that went to market with a cover that you designed, but you also included many times variations that you created that you would have preferred go to market. And one of my favorite examples on your website was for the book How to Cook Like a Man. And you said that the sort of brief in your own mind was me want food, me cook, seems like a natural corollary for the title. And How to Cook Like a Man went to market with kind of what you'd expect cover. And what you actually created that you would have preferred had a very strategically placed whisk and two eggs. And I'll let our listeners decide in their own minds how they want to construct those elements. Why on earth wouldn't they go with something that interesting and witty and humorous and provocative all at the same time?
I think it depends. Again, depends on the client, depends on like the project. I think publishing even though it's not a high profit margin business, is becoming more and more conservative. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons that I think Knopf did so well. I mean, when you have Sunny Mehta, one of the, again, is an enlightened tyrant. He appreciates design. He appreciates...
Yeah, no, and Chip says that very explicitly. Chip Kidd, of course, from Random House, one of the great book cover designers of all time. Chip says very, very specifically that he couldn't do what he was doing if it weren't for Sunny Mehta.
Exactly. And I think that not enough, you don't have that many in publishing anymore. It's becoming, I think, more and more conservative.
You've branched out into both restaurant branding and packaging. And do you find that your approach differs in these disciplines, or is it a very similar way in?
I think it's very similar. I think one of the things that I like about working in branding or in the restaurants is that the thing with when you do a book jacket, you read the book, you come up with a concept, and you flesh out the concept, and you have the one-off. I mean, you have this, this poster. And then imagine if you could adapt this poster now for a menu, now for a postcard, you adapt that idea for all these different other, and you created this system. So I think that, they can correlate. Because in a sense, you're creating a narrative. So it's it's a narrative for the book, it's a narrative for, the restaurants, it's a narrative for the branding. It's you're creating a story. So if you have more pieces, that story can be better fleshed out, better displayed.
So three different restaurants that you've worked on include Il Pittore in Philadelphia, Mai Tai in Rio, and Cafe Storico in New York City. And I just watched a video of you online talking with Matteo Bologna about the design of the Stephen Starr's restaurant, Park, the French restaurant. And I was really fascinated by the notion of what makes something authentic. And you both questioned how something could be authentic if it wasn't created in its place of origin. So how do you create an authentic environment when, in fact, by the sheer virtue of being a Thai restaurant in Brazil or an Italian restaurant in Philadelphia, you're already somewhat inauthentic by being outside of the country that you are really coming from?
I think, for instance, with Il Pittore, the food that it was creating was art. It was it was lovely, and they are delicious. I mean, they're really, if you go to Philadelphia, go to Il Pittore, they have a bombolini that is to die for. So since you have this name, the name Il Pittore, so what about if the plates are the canvas, if the menus are the canvas? So in a sense, it becomes all about how, when you see in restaurant photographs, they have those brush strokes of balsamic vinegar or of mustard. In a sense, it's very much to be an artist. With Mai Tai, it was a friend of mine who live in New York. I mean, they are Brazilians. They have never been to Thailand, but they love Thai food all the time they were in New York. And they wanted to do something that was healthy and yet was fast. And so they had not that much money. I mean, I actually love little projects like that when you have no much money, but you can do whatever you want. And so I came up with with this ambigram for a logo. So it was, the logo would have to be displayed in every package. So in a sense, let's have a memorable image. And so whatever, do you know what an ambigram is?
Yes.
When you have, you can read back and forth.
Wow. The word
or
wow.
Or you could read sometimes you, have two different words, one back and one forth. It's very much, I think it became quite famous because of the Dan Brown books, the Da Vinci Code,
yes,
or the Angels and Demons. So, but restaurants, you have each different restaurant has a story, and you have to narrate the story and create, translate, the ideas graphically into the package, the signage, in order to convey the narrative that they want. And also, I think I love, with restaurants, it's almost this Disneyfication. I mean, it's a kind of a theme park. So in a sense,
restaurants is theme park, absolutely.
Yeah. Let's go to France, turn of the century, or or 1920 Italy, or so it's a little bit, when you go to a restaurant, you are paying, for the trip. And I mean, what is authentic? I mean, in a sense, when you look to know back, it's we are in different time. We still love the same food. We still love like not the frisé or lardon, like the or you know, you love the French food. So it's much nice if you're surrounding by the place where that that food was created for. So in a sense, you have the environment where the food was created for. It is authentic. It's not. But then in a sense, like, aren't we always recreating, I mean, nothing is authentic. Everything is like, it's a recreation.
It's a construct. Yeah,
construct. Yeah. So.
Well, you and Matteo also talked about needing to create a level of authenticity. And this really stopped me. I had to listen to this a couple of times. So you talked about needing to create a level of authenticity that was so modern that any graphic designer wouldn't know it's modern.
I think that's one of the problems. If you only recreate something that already existed, it looks dated, and it looks and when you look back, when you go like, there's always this haphazard quality that sometimes it would be not polished enough for a client today. Because a lot of times, especially like French restaurants, they are family business. So like the grandfather bought the place, and then his son took the place over and decided to change some little things, and the grandkid came and changed a little bit. So in a sense, it's like this melange of the history. So you are faking not only a specific time in place, but you're also recreating all this history. So in a sense, it's difficult because you do want to do something that belongs to a period, but also you don't want to become so part of that period that it becomes old immediately. So in a sense, it has to have some, is how I see that specific point in time. Otherwise, you just can Xerox something that existed and printed. So in a sense, you have what is... I love the swell rules. So let's put the swell rules all over. I mean, those kind of little things that, I love that in every Victorian advertisement, you have to have at least 20 different typefaces in one page. I love that. I mean, the thing goes against the idea of modernity. So let's use 20 wonderful typefaces.
Somewhere Massimo Vignelli is crying. So in the same conversation that you had with Matteo, you also talked about believing that one of the roles of graphic design is to make an audience feel intelligent.
I think it's very important.
So how do you go about doing that?
I think one of the main things is humor. I think if you have something that has humor, the audience, it laughs with you. And then so they feel intelligent. They feel
like they get
smart.
It somehow?
Yeah, really smart. And then they appreciate it. I think that's one of the important, how humor is so important to work. Because also life is hard. Like, let's give a break to the general public. Like, make life a little easier, a little gentler and happier by just this little witty thing that you can create.
So, yeah, I think it's about the wit.
Yeah.
As much as it is about the humor.
On the park, we did... it's this beautiful French restaurant right in front of Rittenhouse Square in Philadelphia. I think it was a laundry, and then they, discarded everything, and they make this French bistro from 1890. And so we decided, with the name Park, let's do a little silhouette of animals that would be in the park, working in the kitchen. So you have, a little pigeon as the waiter. You had, the
dogs. Buzz,
the maître d' was dog. We had a bunch of animals, and each animal has a different function in the restaurant. And they have one of them that was this little squirrel that was the bartender, was Luke. And then so we created a little, so it was just little things that, it was fun to do, and and people relate to it, and they're fun.
This talk about animals reminds me of one of the anecdotes that you have written about, wherein you describe the parts of an elephant to branding and how you see them in a very similar fashion. And I want to share that with you and our listeners. You said, "You know the story of the blind man and the elephant. The first held the tail, the second the feet, the third the torso, the fourth the trunk. Each saw something different. It's the same with your business. You know all the parts and you want to emphasize your best features. We can see the parts, the whole, and the spirit behind it. Great design and great typography can unify all of your best assets into its proper shape to create your brand." And my question to you, Roberto, is how? How does great design and typography unify all of your best assets into its proper shape to create your brand?
I think one of the things first is, again, the idea of being a foreigner. I mean, you are in a different environment, and you know, you have this client who are really in the thick of trying, like, you know, to sell things. Then, I mean, the function of the designer is to, you know, work with the client to understand what the job is and help place that into the context of the market, and also to try, like, to, you know, learn with your client the process of, like, you know, what's out there that is exactly like you. How do you differentiate yourself from these people? What is your story that's different from everyone else? So you help to collect all these different informations and create, like, you know, something, you know, a narrative that is...
So that's how you interpret it?
Yes.
That's really, really interesting. I'm very curious about your books. You have three books. In 2000, you created an alphabet book for your daughter titled Bembo's Zoo, your daughter Genevieve's first Christmas, I believe. And you called it Bembo's Zoo because you used the font Bembo to create 26 different animals, one for each letter of the alphabet. So for the letter A, for example, the letters that make up the word antelope are manipulated to form the creature's outline. And you did the same thing for bison and for crab, all the way through to unicorn, yak, and zebra. So what is it about the letter forms of the alphabet that intrigue you so much that you want to actually create characters out of characters?
I think the whole story started that my wife is a wasp, and like I love her, and I love, you know, her family. And every Christmas we had not that much food, a lot of drink.
Very waspy.
Yeah, and you know, we were supposed to give gifts to the kids, but between the adults, we have to make things. We have, like, you know, to do, everything has to be handmade.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Very old-fashioned.
Yeah, exactly. The problem is me and my wife are the only ones who had X-Acto knives, glue guns, and everything, you know, and crafty things or a computer. Most of the things, you know, I would get, I mean, for a while we had at our home, we had this birdhouse that we called the birdhouse of Dr. Caligari, because not one wall met. It was like an German expressionist birdhouse.
So great.
It was things that, like, you know, that would live in our house for a month and then it would be trashed out. So I decided, you know, if I have to do a present, let's try, like, to do this an alphabet book, because my daughter, I was, you know, she was two, and she I was trying, like, you know, to teach her Portuguese as well besides English. So I was trying, like, to find an alphabet book that I could use both for Portuguese and English. So, for instance, normally when you have an alphabet book in English, A is always for alligator. But in Portuguese, you know, the word alligator is jacaré, it starts with J. So in a sense, like, you know, I couldn't use the same. So I decided, well, I would make my own book for her. And since I'm not an illustrator, I decided, well, and I'm a graphic designer, I said, like, let's use, you know, the letter forms, because she would recognize the letter forms, and then she would see how combining those letter forms you can create the word. And so I did, like, you know, that, and I showed to a friend of mine who had was an editor-in-chief for a publishing house, and then he liked the idea, and so, you know, the book got published.
What made you decide to use Bembo?
Because the typeface, it looks really beautiful in large size and small sizes. So in a sense, you need a typeface that was, you know, classic letter form, but yet, like, you know, that even though in terms of size, would they would look beautifully displayed.
So you followed this up with your most recent book, a remarkable effort titled Men of Letters and People of Substance, which is a gallery of famous portraits entirely created by letters and objects. And in the introduction, Francine Prose described this book as a book that makes the alphabet sing and proof of how much can be accomplished with language. And it's true, Roberto, it's so true. You have the ability to express emotion in a cue, or as you put it, the mane of Oscar Wilde or Mark Twain's mustache have their equivalent shapes respectively in the characters D of Avalon and W in Cochin. How did you discover that? I mean, how did you find out that Mark Twain's mustache has an equivalent shape in the character of D in the typeface Avalon?
I think that, you know, when Bimbozo was going to press, they asked me like for a photo to put on the flap of the book. And I decided that, like, no, I mean, I hate any photo of me because I'm always fatter and bolder than I thought I would, you know, that I hear you. So I decided, well, let's do, instead of like, you know, a photo, I mean, the only photo that I had that I was thinking to send to the publisher was a 6-month picture of a baby, since it was a bit, you know, children's book.
Oh, I get it.
But I decided, well, if I can do this with the animals, let's see if I can do a portrait of myself only using the letters of my name. So I started, like, you know, playing with the, you know, the letters. And then, you know, one thing led to another. Let's see if you can do that. I mean, you can start pushing, like, to see how it works. And I think one of the things that I liked about that was also because I was trying, like, to combine the idea. I mean, you amass this great library of fonts when you work, and you love these fonts, and you don't have a project like to work with all these fonts. So I decided, like, no, well, let's see if I can, like, you know, do something with that. So it was a way of, like, you know, searching a little bit the time period of the specific author, and then, you know, trying to find a font that, like, you know, that matches, you know, that, for instance, you know, Marcel Proust. I mean, you use, like, you know, I use Oriol, that's like this typeface from, like, from the turn of the century. So it was beautiful, and it matches, like, somehow you could match the figure with the typeface. And sometimes with portraits, sometimes also you find something that defines the idea of a caricature. You find, like, one specific strong
gesture,
element that, like, that gives the character, the portrait, like, its personality. And then sometimes you find a typeface that has that little element that, you know, fits perfectly as into a nose or into a mane or into a mustache.
Or a woman's legs. There's a marvelous exercise that you have on the Type Directors Club website about how to make love to your type, I believe is the title.
Yes.
And you see all sorts of very risque examples of how type follows the shape of the human anatomy.
Well, the thing is also, I always forget about, you know, specific elements of the typeface. I mean, what is this thing that sticks up? Is it a sender? Oh, the thing that sticks down, the sender. What is
the bowl?
Little, the bowl or the little
the tail.
Exact. So in a sense, they are all names that relate to human body. So that we were doing something like we wanted to do a little printed object that would serve as something, you know, for the members, like, to have as an inspiration piece, but also, like, to promote the Type Directors Club. So they offered me if I wanted to do something, and I said, oh, yes, you know, I always had this idea, so let's, you know, try that. And after that, we had, like, so many other, you know, Gail Anderson did a wonderful piece on the Santeria's, and Jessica Hish did a little poster, and Will Steele did a little series of postcards. We always try at TDC to do some little printed object that, like, serve as an inspiration, serve as an interesting piece for our members.
I read an interview with you wherein you stated a letter is much more than a representation of a symbol. A letter depicts a time period, a certain mood, and perhaps the soul of the artist. And I'm wondering how you go about constructing that soul.
I think is the idea of your sensibility, your personality. So in a sense, it's a collection of all these moments in time where you find things that you like or that reflect your sensibility or that you act upon and you create pieces of design. I think your artwork in the end, you know, your portfolio becomes like, you know, your face, your soul, your, you know, your spirit. I think it's one of the strangest things that I've ever seen was some time ago, a friend of mine had a friend who died, and he was not a religious person. His family was in the Midwest, and the guy was interior designer. And so they had a little get-together of all his clients and his families in the house that he designed. And there was, you know, champagne and people talking about him. And in the coffee table, there was his portfolio. For me, it was the strangest thing to, you know, to see, you know, I mean, this is a little bit life in New York City. You are so much the work that you do that the portfolio was his presence, was his, you know, lifetime achievement. So it was, like, you know, quite beautiful, like, in the strange, you know. I mean, normally you're accustomed, like, to see, you know, in Catholic churches or like in the, right. But now he's in New York. I mean, he's like, you know, in the time that you are secular. So there was like, you know, that portfolio that represented him, and it was his soul. But I think also the most one of the most important things in terms of graphic design, I think that's the only thing that is specific to graphic design, is typography. Everything else you borrow from the other arts. You borrow, like, you know, the images from the photography, from painting, from. But the only thing that is specific material for graphic design is typography. So you have to know type, and you have to know to learn the history of type, and you have, like, to be willing to play with type. Because I think that the more that you can, the more expressive you become, and the more, you know, the better designer you become.
Thank you, Roberto.
Thank you, Debbie.
To learn more about Roberto de Vic de Comtish, visit devic.com. That's Vic spelled V-I-C-U. I'd like to thank you for listening. And remember, we can talk about making a difference, we can make a difference, or we can do both. I'm Debbie Millman, and I look forward to talking with you again soon.
Design Matters with Debbie Millman is recorded at the Masters in Branding Studio at the School of Visual Arts in New York City. It is produced by Curtis Fox Productions. The show is published exclusively by DesignObserver.com. You can subscribe to this free podcast in the iTunes Store.
You're growing a business, and you can't afford to slow down. If anything, you could probably use a few more hours in the day. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.